crooked thorn. Up in the north a boy was born. His hair was black and his eyes were blue. His mouth turned up at the corners too. A fairy stood beside his bed. You shall never, never grow old, she said. Paul Bunyan is to be your name. Then she departed whence she came. You must believe me when I say he grew 6 inches every day. You must believe me when I speak. He gained 3, 4, 6 pounds every week. He grew so fast by the time he was 8. He was as tall as the Empire State. The length of his stride's a historical fact. 3.7 miles to be exact. When he ordered a jack at the New England mills, for months had no more unemployment ills. When he wanted a snapshot to send to his friends, they found they had to use a telephoto lens.
Two Englishmen, Benjamin Britten and W.H. Auden, got right to the heart of a great American myth in their 1941 opera, Paul Bunyan, with some help from singer there, Pop Wagner, in a more recent rendering. Where did the legendary larger-than-life logger come from in the first place? Wisconsin, possibly? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
When did Paul Bunyan first appear, and is there a historical prototype for him? How has the legend fared at a time when chopping down trees can be more like villainy than heroism to some people? And what's with that blue ox, Babe? Our guest with the answers is Michael Edmonds, Assistant Director of Library Archives Division of the Wisconsin Historical Society and author of Out of the North Woods, The Many Lives of Paul Bunyan, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press in 2009.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
With Paul Bunyan, he seems to be the most popular or well-known folk hero in America. Is that right?
That's generally what he's called, America's best-known folk hero. And by the time Britten and Auden wrote that opera that you just opened with, his reputation had swept the nation. Every American knew his name by then.
And where do we start seeing the beginnings of Paul Bunyan? Where did it come from?
Well, for a long time, people thought that it had dated back to colonial New England. And some people even traced it back to Europe. But in fact, as I went through the archives of Bunyan collectors, the earliest documented evidence for a Paul Bunyan story is from right here in Wisconsin, the winter of 1885.
So recent.
Yes. It's interesting that motifs in the stories often do go back to the 18th century or the 19th century in New England. But Paul Bunyan as a character, as a personality, started right here near Tomahawk, Wisconsin in the 1880s.
What kind of person?
Was Paul Bunyan? Well, there was no historical Paul Bunyan, but there was a figure that the lumberjacks themselves talked about. And in the oral tradition, which lasted for about 30 years, 1885 to 1915, he was a lumberjack like themselves. Often he was a foreman, a crew leader, but he was an illiterate, hardworking, all-American kind of guy. Later, he got turned into something else.
Illiterate. That's kind of interesting that that would be one of the traits that they would single out.
I think they wanted someone they could identify with, and there are stories in which he keeps track of his men's hours by cutting notches in sticks because he couldn't write.
How is he like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone? Is he sort of in the same frontier hero tradition?
I think that he became popular at the same time and rode the same wave that they did. But they, of course, were historical figures, mm-hmm. and he was entirely made up.
And if you go back even before the Wisconsin version, what kind of tales or renderings do you see where you see sort of the archetype of Paul Bunyan, the sort of tradition?
Well, the idea of a powerful male hero, of course, goes back to Hercules and Thor, and I'm not a professional folklorist, but probably every culture has something like that. The motif of the stories themselves, some of them go back to examples that of the New World impressing immigrants who came over during the colonial era. There are stories from New England about snow so deep it buried the trees that then reappear with Paul Bunyan as a hero.
And in 1885, then, what exactly is the setting for his appearance?
During the 1880s, the labor force of lumberjacks in the Great Lakes absolutely exploded. In the 1880 census, there are about 3,500. 10 years later, there are 18,000. So there are a lot of novice newcomers coming in. And the stories begin as a way for the old veterans to tease them and make fun of these naive newcomers. Lumbering was very hard, and of course it was done in the winter, brutally cold. And it's easy to imagine, after supper, they're sitting around and some 17-year-old farm boy says, "Boy, it was cold today." And a grizzled old veteran who's been cutting down trees for 30 years says, "Cold? You think this is cold? Why, when I worked for Paul Bunyan." And that's the way the stories were initially told.
Now, what are some of the key elements? I mean, the piece from the opera that we opened with had to do with the birth of Paul Bunyan. But, I mean, give us some of the kind of standard features of the plot.
Well, the stories were generally improvised, so there are no standard features. When they were told in lumber camps, they were made up on the spot. Groups of people would cooperate to amplify each other's tales. And so there isn't anything like, say, the Arthurian legends, where they're all the same. Some of the motifs that got widely repeated were, of course, Bunyan's size and strength and cleverness, and his sidekick, the ox, are in most of the stories. He lumbered off North Dakota completely. That's why there are no trees.
Somebody
there.
Obviously did, right?
That is one of the earliest motifs. Many of the stories are said to have taken place at a location called the Pyramid 40. This was a 40-acre tract that was shaped like a pyramid, and a lot of stories take place there. It was a pyramid because he could get so much lumber off it compared to off 40 acres of flat land. But it came with disadvantages. For example, they had to sharpen their axes by rolling boulders down the hill and holding their axes on them. There were ferocious animals there that hated loggers, like the side hill gouger, an animal that would devour loggers. But because it lived on that steep hill, it had legs that were shorter on one side than the other. It could only go in one direction around the hill. So long as you were behind it, you were okay. This hill, according to Wisconsin lumberjacks, was so high that it took a steady week of looking to see the top of it.
Do we see any particular reason why logging would have given birth to a figure like this? Is there something about the profession, do you think, that made tales, tall tales, so appealing? The magnificent size of trees and the age of the trees, there's something kind of gigantic and magnificent about trees themselves.
There is. That's part of it, probably. I think also at the time that the stories are born, there's a great deal of exaggeration in the lumber industry as people are trying to cheat one another out of tracts of land. But there were devices lumber companies used to get more timber than they were entitled to.
I'm kind of intrigued about the appearance of Babe the Blue Ox in 1885. Were lumbermen still using oxen to cut down harvest trees in 1885?
The fact that there's an ox is an indicator that they're talking about old times, because it's in the early 80s that horses begin to supplant oxen. They're much easier to handle, of course. And by having all these stories take place when there's an ox, they're dating them in the past.
Sort of the time of legends.
That's right.
Why blue? Why a blue?
Well, is it that cold?
Well, exactly. He was white when he first entered the logging camps, but he laid out in the snow 7 days and seven nights during the winter of the blue snow and turned forever blue. And people who live up north will tell you that sometimes the snow does appear to be blue.
Sure, right. So getting back to that first appearance of Paul Bunyan in 1885, in what form? Is it newspaper articles? Is it a published story by a named author? Or where does that date come from?
It's oral tradition that I unearthed in the archives of early collectors of the tales. The name Paul Bunyan does not appear in print until 1904. But there are two independently recorded recollections of the stories being told that winter near Tomahawk, Wisconsin. They were told by a timber cruiser, someone who went out in advance of the lumberjacks to survey the tracts of forest and estimate how much timber was there. And he was traveling across northern Wisconsin, staying in lumber camps as he went. And every night at this one camp, he would tell one of these tall tales about someone he used to work for. They get gradually more and more extraordinary until on the last night, everybody realized that they were being teased and they threw their galoshes and everything else at the poor timber cruiser. But there are two different, unconnected recollections of Bunyan in Bunyan stories being told there in that place at that time.
And what were some of the characteristics of those early stories?
Bunyan's great strength and mm-hmm. cleverness, the incredible brutality of the work and living conditions are common themes in the very first stories.
Was he so giant the way he was in that opera thing where he's the size of the Empire State? Was he so exaggerated that it was obvious it was a fiction?
No, not at all. That yeah. all comes later. That comes mm-hmm. in the 1920s when the mass media gets a hold of him. Back then, one of the stories starts out, Bunyan was a powerful giant 7 feet tall with a stride of 7 feet.
So a good basketball player.
A very big lumberjack.
Mm-hmm. But not something that's King Kong-like.
Not fabulous at all. Because to the loggers, he was one of them, and he allowed them to realize that no matter how bad things were, they'd been worse, and Paul Bunyan had got them out of it.
Were there any political implications the way you might have with Robin Hood or anything? Was there a class angle to the figure of Paul Bunyan?
Again, not until he gets into print and it's professional writers dealing with him. Then he becomes much more like a middle-class manager. Taylorism enters into how he's going to run his logging camps and such. But in the early oral tradition, no.
And how quickly does the story spread? I suppose you have to wait for the mass media for this thing to spread beyond Wisconsin?
Not really. The first stories are from the mid-80s, and by 1890, in the early 90s, they're being told all over the Great Lakes region and into Canada. That was because lumbering was a seasonal occupation.
Right.
And so every fall, people with those skills might try to find some new place to go
that
would pay better.
And
so it was a very mobile
story.
Exactly. A transient labor force carried the stories everywhere within just a few years.
Any accounts of his birth in these early stories?
None.
What about his appearance? What was he said to look like besides his height?
Well, it's interesting because the image that we all have that was certainly in the public mind by the time of that opera was of sort of a jovial buffoon with mustache and soft. But the first drawing of Paul Bunyan, which was drawn by someone who told the tales often in the 90s, makes him look sort of like a Neanderthal or a Yeti. He's definitely a lumberjack that's been in the woods all winter, needs a shave and a bath very badly.
And the illiteracy that you mentioned, where does that come in?
In the 80s and the 90s, lumber camps were a very multicultural environment. There were lots of people who didn't speak English well, who couldn't communicate with one another, people who had no other skills. And so I think it was a pretty common phenomenon. It's interesting because earlier in the 1840s and 50s, when lumbering first gets going, they're passing around the novels of Sir Walter Scott. They're mm-hmm. reading Jane Austen out loud. But a generation later, and it's all illiterate working class guys.
Because you have that mix of backgrounds. Or it was originally the lumbering in Wisconsin, I guess, goes back to, what, maybe the 1850s?
A little earlier, the 40s. And it's people from...
Mostly Yankees from New England.
Yankees have the capital and the know-how, and a lot of the labor is provided by French Canadians who would have gone into the fur trade, except the animals have all been trapped here, the fur trade's gone west, and they become loggers.
What are some of the things that Paul Bunyan, in these early stories through oral tradition... What are some of the things he's said to do?
In the oral tradition, they're generally feats that the loggers themselves had to face. He breaks up log jams. He fells enormous trees. He runs a camp with many, many more people than one would think possible. So they're very pragmatic, down-to-earth, practical kinds of triumphs that he has.
Any conquests over wild animals and, you know, sort of the way you – the Quillen of slaying a dragon.
He was a great hunter. When it was necessary to provide food for the camp, he, for instance, designed a gun that could kill geese so high in the air that they would spoil before they reached the ground. He was a great tracker of game. He came across, according to one of these stories, the carcass of a dead moose, and having some time on his hands, he tracked it all the way back to where it had been born. So there are stories like that, but none of the classic mythological combats where the hero has to surmount obstacles in order to reach the climax of the tale. There's nothing that formal.
So we actually then, you mentioned this date, 1904, do we have a collection of these stories at this point, or is it all coming from one source?
There are really three sources that enter print about the same time. The 1904 story is in a Duluth newspaper, and it's just a passing reference to the lumberjacks and their tales about this guy. In 1906, there's a collection published in Oscoda, Michigan, which is north of Detroit, and it prints the first version of the Pyramid 40 story and another story of events that take place on a round river. He's supposed to floats the logs downstream to a mill, and they keep going and going. They don't realize there's no outlet. It's a round river. The first national publication to put any body of stories before the public, any large body, was 1910 in Milwaukee. And those appeared in a magazine called Outer's Book, kind of like Field and Stream. And a journalist from Duluth published them there. I think it's about 30 stories altogether.
And we have a larger-than-life character at that point?
Yes, larger-than-life. No, but quite an extraordinary, strong and clever lumberjack. But he's not doing magical things.
So what about women in the life of Paul Bunyan at this point?
Well, the early stories mention that he did have a wife, and some of them mention that he had daughters. But in general, they don't figure into the stories because the stories were created in an all-male environment, isolated from the rest of the world. And were made to highlight his traditionally masculine features and virtues.
And he's always in the woods. He doesn't have to go indoors. And it's kind of like I think about Mark Twain and how often the men feel so stifled in the parlor. Getting out on the river or in the woods is a taste of freedom. Is some of that in Paul Bunyan?
I can't think of a story where he's not outdoors.
We're going to backtrack a little. See what the life of a real lumberjack was like in Wisconsin in the 19th century and get a clearer picture of our friend Paul Bunyan when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Michael Edmonds, who has done research into that character Paul Bunyan and found out that, well, he seems to have come from Wisconsin. At least that's where the stories originated. So far as we can tell. There's a whole culture of lumbering in the 19th century, though. There was a whole way of life that I guess changed pretty quickly. If we go back to the 1840s, the date you mentioned for the beginnings, what was it like and how did it change as these legends emerged?
Well, it was very informal. There were no big lumbering businesses in the 1840s and even the 50s. It's really not until after the Civil War that you begin to see large-scale lumber businesses in Wisconsin. In fact, the first settlers in Wisconsin in the 1830s had to ship their lumber from out east. It would come down rafts down the Ohio.
It's hard to imagine,
isn't it? Isn't it? So it's not till later in the century that logging turns into a big business. It was always a brutal occupation. As late as 1919, a government commission found that because of the industrial accidents, logging was more dangerous than warfare.
Well, because of trees falling on people, axe injuries.
Drownings in the spring when they floated the logs downstream. In the mills where the logs were cut into lumber, of course, there were no safety precautions in those days. There are a lot of stories in the Bunyan canon about lumberjacks that have limps or are missing parts of their bodies. Because in every logging camp, there were a number of guys like that.
Mm-hmm. In the 1840s, we mentioned using oxen, and you'd have to raise them up in some kind of a rig and put shoes on them, which I gather was quite the enterprise in itself. But at this point, we're talking axes rather than saws?
Double-bladed axes were used until the 1870s. It's only in the 70s that a saw is invented that will pull the sawdust out on the return trip that's generated when it cuts in, and that was necessary to cut the large trees.
If we move from the real lumberjacks back to the Paul Bunyan tales, the early tales, what does the blue ox start doing in these early stories? What is Babe? And is he called Babe at that point?
He's not called Babe. It's the advertisers in the 20th century that make up the name Babe. In the early stories, he's just the blue ox. He's very headstrong and very powerful. One of the most widely circulated anecdotes says that one day Paul and Babe pulled a whole house up a hill and then returned and pulled the cellar up afterwards. So you can see how powerful the animal must have been. Oxen were famous for being recalcitrant and not obeying orders, and so there are many stories about the levels of profanity needed to keep Babe
That's
going
how Babe
about
really
his business.
Blue.
And what sort of effect did it have? You mentioned that these stories then start appearing in newspapers like in Milwaukee and so on. When you have the mass media getting hold of the stories, what starts to change?
Well, they change fundamentally in the 20s when they become popular. It's interesting because in 1910 and then again in 1914 when they're printed and distributed, no one cares. I mean, American culture is facing east. It's all about Henry James and Edith Wharton. Nobody cares about the private jokes of lumberjacks. And then it's in 1922 that a lumber company adopts Bunyan as their logo, their brand icon, and they issue a product catalog that has a page description of what they have to sell and a Bunyan story, and a page description of what they're selling and a Bunyan story. And they didn't copyright it because they felt anybody who took their stories and talked about Paul Bunyan was talking about them. And the stories escaped, much in the way that music is escaping now with different technology. The stories were plagiarized and made it into Eastern periodicals. And by 1925, two different publishers are bringing out books of Bunyan fiction for adults that are competing with one another.
For adults?
For adults. He was not a children's hero at the start.
Did the company that started it, did they do well with this? I mean, was it a successful marketing tool?
It was. It was. They stamped a logo with that picture of him that we identify with today on every piece of wood, every invoice, every piece of correspondence, and they nicknamed all their products Bunyan's Pine. And it did work. It was the Red River Lumber Company owned by a man named Archie Walker, the money behind the Walker Art Institute in the Twin Cities.
Do we have other characters in the Bunyan myth other than Paul and Babe?
He had a cook named Sourdough Sam, famous for sourdough bread, which was a staple in all logging camps, who's the hero of many stories, and a camp clerk named Johnny Inkslinger, who invented a fountain pen and saved Bunyan lots of money by not crossing his T's or dotting his I's. There are about a dozen characters that reappear in those later 1920s stories.
When do you start seeing the first examples of the magic, the giant, the fairy tale, the part that can't be described as any, you know, that where it's just out of bounds?
Yeah, that starts right in the mid-20s. The first children's books come at the end of the 1920s as well. What happened was when the stories were only told in logging camps, the speaker, the creator of the tale, and the listener were the same. Everybody was expected to participate and build the story, keep it going along. They were a private commodity, not a public one, and they were meant to reinforce, reassure the very same people who created them. But when they emerge out of there into the public marketplace, it's not lumberjacks who are making them up. It's editors and advertisers or novelists, and they're not a private commodity. They're public. They're supposed to be sold. At the same time, since they're folklore, anybody can make it up, right? Who's the author of folklore? Anybody can make this up. And so they just mushroom with anything that a publisher thinks will sell.
Do you have evidence that some people got confused and thought there was an actual Paul Bunyan?
The
way
yes.
Sometimes people go looking for Sherlock Holmes or, you know, it happens where people are sort of trying to track.
When I do book talks, there's always one person who says, was there a real Paul Bunyan? So people are still confused about this. Some of the early collectors of the tales who in the 20s were trying to figure out how it all started tried to discover a real person. Charles Brown, who was the head of the Historical Museum here and the biggest Bunyan collector in Wisconsin, wrote to contacts in Canada who found that there were actually many lumberjacks named Paul Bunyan. And they didn't know the tales and they didn't know, you know, the reputation, but there was always somebody around a logging camp named Paul Bunyan.
How do the images change, the visual depictions?
The first one I mentioned, he looks like a Neanderthal. Then there are some in lumber trade journals during the First World War that are crude line drawings where he looks sort of like a professional wrestler. And in the 20s is when that Red River Company caricature of what Bunyan might have looked like just sweeps the nation. And then he pretty much always looks like that. People are playing off that well-known image rather than creating any new icon.
Well, I have to think back to around third or fourth grade, but the story as I heard it then, and I can't even tell you what the medium was that Paul Bunyan kind of represented this earlier way of life, and that he and Babe got into a contest with a more mechanized method of chopping wood and maybe lost by, you know, a rabbit hair's width of lumber, and that he kind of faded into history with Babe the Blue Ox. Does that story at all sound familiar? And if not, what has Paul Bunyan really come to represent over the course and the force of these legends as they pile up?
That's a pretty common theme. If you think you get the stories about John Henry, the pile-driving man who's trying to beat the jackhammer. And there's my favorite book from my 1950s childhood about Mike Mulligan and the steam shovel. And could the guys with the shovel beat the steam shovel? So obviously Americans were uneasy with industrialization in the first half of the 20th century. Bunyan does not fade away because of mechanization. By the 1920s, lumbering is mechanized, and people aren't, the guys who are doing the work are not talking about Paul Bunyan. They wouldn't get those jokes anymore. He's made it, he's migrated completely into the mass media. What made him so popular in the 20s and 30s was, first, America had been catapulted onto the world stage during World War I. You know, those two sides went at each other for 4 years. We came in, tipped the scales, and we're the heroes. So we needed some kind of a mythological hero to rank next to Thor and Hercules. And people just seized on Bunyan and said, this is America at its best. The second thing goes to what one of you was saying a minute ago. By the 20s, most Americans no longer lived in the country. They lived either in the suburbs or the cities. But they could all remember the frontier and the country and the farm and the forest. And so Bunyan was a way that they could capture nostalgically those years of their youth. Of course, that vanished with the next generation who couldn't remember any wilderness of their own. And that's when Bunyan turns into this fantastic mythological hero.
Any sort of faults that Paul Bunyan seems to have? I mean, any foibles, any trickery? Or on the flip
heroic
side, too.
Flaw.
Yeah, I guess I don't think of Paul Bunyan from my memories of any tales I've ever read as having a sort of morality, either plus or minus. He just sort of is there with his axe.
He could be a very hard taskmaster. He's a hard person to work for in some of the stories. There's one story collected in Wisconsin about 1915 in which he works all winter, works his men hard, and then on the last day he informs them they've accidentally been cutting land that belonged to the government and they better seize their belongings and run as fast as they can if they want to avoid jail. And then he collects all the proceeds. So he profits from all their labor and sends them heading for the horizon.
So that's the trickster then.
But that's the only example of that from the oral tradition.
Anything and where he does some act of kindness or rescues someone?
Some moral decision. Oh,
he's always rescuing people. Mm-hmm. He's always saving people. There's an element of wish fulfillment in those early oral tales. But he demanded strict obedience, and he was overtly powerful. You obviously wanted to do what this guy said. He was very big and strong. When he spoke, it shook the limbs from the trees. You know, people obeyed him.
Did he have adversaries then?
In the later stories, the 1920s stories, he does have adversaries, the heads of other lumber crews. In logging culture, when they would come out of the woods in the spring, they would all converge on cities, and fist fights and drunken brawls were commonplace. The fist fights to loggers were like gunfights were to cowboys. And so there are stories in which Bunyan goes up against adversaries and always wins.
How does he become linked to the Midwest in particular? I mean, I've seen things where it's like, what, he stamps his foot and it makes a Great Lake. Right. It also, with this sort of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan kind of area, I mean, how does he sort of fit in with the Midwestern ethos?
I think he emerges at a time when lumbering is at its height in this part of the country. Between 1880 and 1910, nearly all the trees in this part of America were cut down. I mean, people go up north, they think they're going to the wilderness, but those are all new trees. The trees in this part of the country disappeared as fast as the buffalo disappeared off the plains. And about the same time. And that's when the stories are at their height. So they're associated in their early days with this part of the country because that's where the industry was. Then after the turn of the 20th century, during the First World War, it all moves to the Northwest where there are many more stories about him. Oil gets discovered down in Texas and there are stories about Bunyan in the oil fields in the teens.
Any spirituality to Paul Bunyan? I mean, we think of nature so much in this time period as a place you can go discover the divine, you know, like John Muir writes about trees as sort of a cathedral of the woods. Any kind of epiphanies or moments of revelation for Paul Bunyan?
Zero.
Zero. I didn't think so.
Just chopped those trees down. So there's never any sense that he is going to run out of trees, that he's been too successful?
On the contrary, there's a sense that the trees are there in order to be cut down. It's a very primitive understanding of the book of Genesis. You know, God gave us this to cut it down. One of the most amazing of the early children's books opens with the trees talking, anthropomorphic trees, talking to each other, saying how wonderful it will be to be cut down and go see their distant relatives in other parts of the world. They won't be stuck stationary here in Wisconsin anymore.
I think there are talking trees in the opera, too. It would serve as kind of like a Greek chorus or something, if I remember right.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a different way of looking at things, but then it's got to be the way that most of those lumbermen did look at it as a product to be harvested. I mean, I have come across accounts where lumberman writing his biography autobiography many years later would say, you know, that he realized that there was something lost when he cut down a tree, but of course kept right on cutting them because that was his purpose.
Right. I'm sure we all do that.
But Paul Bunyan never gave it a thought.
No, he doesn't. When religion shows up in the stories, it's often ridiculed. There were traveling missionaries who would go from logging camp to try to save these drunken brutes' souls. And when they show up in the Bunyan stories, they're just made the butt of all kinds of practical jokes and humor.
Well, once we get to a point where we've chopped all the trees down in the Midwest, how does the legend of Paul Bunyan fare? I mean, I know he goes to the Northwest at that point, but as tastes and sensibilities change over the years, how can a legend like Paul Bunyan, which is so based on just consumption, fare? How does it change at all, or it was just kind of viewed as a different value system?
Well, I think that's when you begin to see the most fantastic stories about him. He makes Puget Sound. That's one of the early, late teens, early 20s stories, before he's in the mass media, but after he's gone west. He hikes with his gigantic strides from Portland back to Minnesota to get something he forgot. So he makes that transition. I don't think there's any transition in the ethos of who he is or what he's up to after the bulk of the industry moved to the Pacific Northwest.
Does he reflect in any way sort of events in American history, the world wars, any kind of anti-communist situation or other things that have to do with the rise of nationalism?
Well, he gets enlisted for every possible cause after he's popular. You know, he becomes wildly popular in the late 20s. And then in the 30s, during the Depression, Northwood's tourist promoters seize on him the way the Red River Lumber Company had. He becomes the icon of the North. But everybody else seized on him, too. I think it's Forbes or Fortune magazine holds him up as the example of the independent, capable American working man that needs no help from a New Deal or unions. But at the same time, the New Masses is holding him up as the emblem of the American working man who can do anything if only those bankers and capitalists would get out of the way. When the war breaks out, the U.S. government uses the image of him in propaganda that's incredibly racist to support the war against Japan. I don't recall seeing things that are anti-Nazi.
What point do the statues start going up?
They're part of the 1930s tourist boom, and they go up everywhere. I recently had an email from somebody in, I think it's Flagstaff, Arizona, wanting to know why there's a Paul Bunyan statue in his town.
They cut all the trees down there, of course.
So everybody began to claim Paul Bunyan in the 30s. He originally came from Bangor, Maine, or he originally came from Portland, Oregon.
Or Bemidji, Minnesota.
Or Bemidji, Minnesota.
Big statue of him there.
Any equivalents to Paul Bunyan in other countries or in Canada?
I don't know of any. Initially, people thought that he was a Canadian hero, and you'll still see that today. If you look in encyclopedias, they'll say it began in Canada. But what I found looking at the history, the folklore of French Canada, was that there's no one like him at all. And the anthropologists and the folklorists there wrote to Americans saying, geez, the only people up here who know about him worked in the Great Lakes forests. There's a French-Canadian character named Bonjean. Some people speculate that that's where Bunyan could have come from. But he's very small. His nickname's Petit Jean.
Yeah.
And so it's not possible. And of course, some of the motifs that come up in the stories are almost universal. They're in every culture.
Sure. Well, we're going to look further at Paul Bunyan and his setting in folklore in general when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
But let me tell you in advance, his dreams were of greater significance. His favorite dream was of felling trees, a fancy which grew by swift degrees. One night he dreamt he was to be the greatest logger in history. He woke to feel something stroking his brow and found it was the tongue of an enormous cow. From horn to horn or from lug to lug was 47 axe heads and a baccy plug. But what would have most bewildered you was the color of her hide, which was bright, bright blue. But Bunyan wasn't surprised at all. Said, I'll call you babe, you call me Paul. He pointed to a meadow, said, take a bite, for you're leaving with me for the south tonight. Over over the mountains, across the streams. They went to find Paul Bunyan's dreams. The bear and the beaver waved a paw. The magpie chattered, the squirrel swore. The trappers ran out from their lonely huts, scratching their heads with their rifle butts. For a year and a day they traveled fast. This is the place, Paul said at last. The forest stretched for miles around. The sound of their breathing was the only sound. Paul picked up pine tree and scratched his shins, said this is the place where our work begins.
That's from the opera Paul Bunyan by Auden and Britton. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Michael Edmonds, who is the author of a book called Out of the North Woods, The Many Lives of Paul Bunyan. You know, I've noticed when working on Jane Austen how many times I'll find a Jane Austen magnet, a board game, an adaptation with vampires, Pride and Prejudice with zombies. It's everywhere. With Paul Bunyan, I know I've seen specials at restaurants where you can get the Paul Bunyan something and it always is big. I'm assuming by now you must have quite the collection of Paul Bunyan in popular culture.
Well, the advertisers really grabbed onto him in the 30s. And then in the 40s as well, he became very well known. So after World War II, you get this explosion of Bunyan iconography in popular culture. There's Paul Bunyan beer, of course, because if you're really macho and you drink the toughest beer, it's going to be
tall
Paul
ones?
Bunyan beer. If you open a newfangled drive-in theater and you want to say you have a really big screen, you have the Paul Bunyan drive-in theater. I've seen ads for that. Of course, in the 50s, as Bunyan's making the shift from adult fiction into children's fiction, a lot of that advertising shifts as well. And so there's all sorts of required boyhood gear of the 1950s that is related to Bunyan. There are fishing lures and Boy Scout patches and hatchets and all sorts of things. In fact, I think in the 40s and 50s, maybe into the 60s, he was a male role model of sorts. Until boys were big enough for the Marlboro Man, they had Paul Bunyan, who was their example of what a successful man would be like.
A little bit healthier role model at that, too.
Any Paul Bunyan theme park?
There was a very popular one, maybe two, in Minnesota. I'm afraid I'm not well-equipped to talk about that. But there's actually a documentary about one that was so popular that tens of thousands of people went every year and have it in their memories today.
What got you interested in Paul Bunyan in the first place?
I was headed for our cottage up north two or three summers ago and wanted to bring some literature of the north with me. I couldn't find any other than Paul Bunyan. So I brought two of the 1920s anthologies, and they were really aghast. I'd never read them before. And they were
Paul
very
Bunyan
funny.
Stories, you mean?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were really funny. So I looked at the editor's introductions to see where they came from, and they gave very conflicting explanations of where Paul Bunyan started. So when I got back to Madison, I looked into the academic literature and folklore, and the professors basically said, there is no oral tradition. This was all made up by advertisers. And I thought, well, wait a minute, what's the truth here? And started to look in the archives around the country of people who had edited the tales in the teens and 20s to see who were their informants, where did these stories come from? And by looking at all the surviving manuscript evidence, I was able to piece together the oral tradition. In fact, the academics were wrong. There was very clearly an oral tradition, and there's vestiges of it. In fact, the last third of my book is all out of the oral tradition.
How does it fit with your work at the Historical Society?
The Historical Society has always had a very Catholic with a small c approach to history. Many cultural institutions believe that only high points are worth collecting. But right from its start 150 years ago, this institution thought history's what everyone remembers. Everybody's part of history. And so there's always been great support there for looking at what common people thought and did, as well as what elites thought and did.
Does Paul Bunyan have any kind of successor in American thinking? I mean, I can't think of a predecessor and I can't think of a successor in terms of this mythological figure who looms so large in the imagination.
Yeah. You know, by the time his reputation's on the wane, say the 1970s, there aren't any heroes of that sort.
No, that was an unheroic decade,
right.
In terms
that's
of
right.
Popular perception.
I can't think of one. I can't think of an iconic popular figure that embodied what so many people thought their national values were. And that's what Bunyan did from 1900 to 1970 or so.
I know there's a Paul Bunyan room at the Memorial Union here in Madison with a mural with Paul Bunyan and so on. Where else are there sort of locations where there's sort of a fictitious, here's the home of Paul Bunyan or come and see this? Like where today, if you wanted to go as a tourist of Paul Bunyan, what would you find?
Well, all over the northern half of the country, literally from Maine to Washington State, there are places that claim to be Paul Bunyan's birthplace or that celebrate him somehow. And this is the remains of that great tourist boom of the 30s and 40s. Certainly Minnesota did a better job of claiming Paul Bunyan than any other state. And Brainerd and Bemidji both had tourist attractions. There's a Paul Bunyan Mall. I believe it's in Bemidji. Paul Bunyan Bike Trail up there. So he's planted firmly all across the northern half of the country now.
That was just a calculated, let's get some tourists here effort?
I think they sincerely believed it because the launching of his reputation came from that Twin Cities Lumber Company, the Red River Lumber Company, and they actually put Bunyan successfully out before the mass media more successfully than anyone else.
It sounds as if there were no women involved in the creating of the Paul Bunyan myth.
It's interesting because really two women are at the heart of it. One of them from right here in Wisconsin, a young woman named Bernice Stewart, who had grown up in the North Country. Her father was a timber cruiser, came to Madison as a freshman in 1912. And for her English paper, for an English paper that first year, she proposed telling some of these stories. And her English professor, a guy named Homer Watt, who went on to be Thomas Wolfe's mentor at NYU, supported her in this and said, do it. And for the next two or three years, he and she actually went out around northern Wisconsin collecting the tales and published the first collection of tales taken from the field in 1916, published here in the Wisconsin Academy Transactions. And still, folklorists look at what she collected as the closest that they can get to the horse's mouth. A second woman was a professor out in Portland who did the same thing among lumberjacks 10 years later in the early 20s. And collected their stories. But unlike Bernice Stewart here, she didn't put them out to the world in the language of lumberjacks. She rearranged the stories into an autobiography or a biography of Paul, and she wrote what she thought was good lumberjack dialect. So you can imagine an academic professor trying to write like a lumberjack.
But she was collecting the stories, but then in effect kind of translating them.
Exactly. She was one of those two books in 1925 that went head-to-head. The other one, interestingly enough, was by a high school dropout. He was a working-class guy who basically moved from, I think it's Ohio, all the way to the Pacific Coast working as a miner and a lumberjack and a hobo. But what he really always wanted to do was write. And H.L. Mencken was one of his heroes. So when Mencken started the American Mercury in 1924, he wrote to him and said, I love your work. And Mencken had just seen stuff about Bunyan and said, do you know any of these Bunyan stories? And so James Stevens, the lumberjack writer, starts creating these stories. Now, he thinks that he should write like Thomas Mann. An academic trying to write like a working class guy, and you have a working class guy trying to write like an academic. And so those two books went head to head from 1925 right into the 1960s as the orthodox versions of Bunyan. Neither of them very good, in my opinion.
What do you suppose was Mencken's attraction to Paul Bunyan? I always think of him as being such an urbanite.
Yeah, I think he was looking for anything that would sell.
He
was published by Alfred Knopf, and Knopf had been looking for Bunyan stories to publish, partly because another upstart young modernist publisher named Harcourt of Harcourt Brace was also after Bunyan tales. And the two of them were looking for the thing that would do it. So that might have been Mencken's interest.
When you were working on your book, Out of the Northwoods, The Many Lives of Paul Bunyan, what surprised you the most in your research? What did you find that you really didn't expect to find?
I expected at first that there would have been dirty jokes about Paul Bunyan. You know, here you have an oral tradition of a lot of men in a competitive situation about a hero who's super masculine. And what body part are men most concerned about? You know? And yet there are no jokes at all. There are no stories at all about Bunyan's sexual prowess. But as I got into it, gradually dawned on me, which I should have known from the start, that at the time the stories were collected, no sane publisher would have touched anything of that sort. And it's not until the 1960s that even Ulysses can be published in America. By that time, they're all dead. So anybody who knew the dirty jokes about Bunyan, of which there were many because collectors refer to them in the abstract, they're all dead and there's no way that we'll know what those stories were.
That was a big part of the lumberjack lifestyle. I mean, you know, you mentioned the fist fights in town, but there was also – it was not all making war in there.
No, I discuss in amusing detail the sex, drugs, and rock and roll that were part of lumberjack life every spring.
Still some places in Wisconsin that are notorious from those years.
From those years, like Hurley.
Exactly, yeah. Hurley being the reputation of having a tough town.
Yeah.
And if you had to say what we can learn from the Paul Bunyan tales and sort of the progression of Paul Bunyan, what would it be? What would we learn about ourselves as a country, as a region, or just as human beings?
The thing that continues to be most interesting to me about it is how private cultural artifacts of working class people could be seized by the commercial sector and turned into a profitable commodity that turns into just a mass market wave. And I think there are some parallels here. You think of Elvis Presley, you know, taking black rhythm and blues music that was a private, non-commercial thing, and again, absolutely sweeps the nation. Or for those of us old enough, the icon of the cigar store Indian. You know, you have mystic warriors of the plains in the mid-19th century, and by the 1920s, they're turned into this
sort of co-opted
sort of symbol. So to me, that's interesting. It's about the force of the economy operating on something as intangible as the private stories of lumberjacks.
When all is said and done, after you've covered all these miles of Paul Bunyan stories, why study folklore? What is the benefit from it that you see from having studied Paul Bunyan?
Well, it gives insights into people who didn't necessarily leave written records. If you only studied published texts, you'll only get the views and opinions and values and desires of people who are literate. Even today, only 25% of Americans go to college. So if you want to collect what all the rest of the people, what their experience is, you turn to things like folklore, things that grow from the bottom up. And to me, that's the benefit of folklore. It preserves the voices of people who would not necessarily be preserved under the structures that create knowledge.
What are some moments in the Paul Bunyan tales that to you are the, I don't know, the most amusing or the most memorable?
Well, I think the ones that stick with most people, not just me, have to do with the very sophisticated logical contradictions and paradoxes that got introduced into these stories. I mean, there are wonderful tropes in these stories that you'd think Lewis Carroll must have done this in Alice in Wonderland. But no, it was just working class loggers who, you know, that hill was so high that one of the guys went blind trying to see to the top. Or there's a guy was such a good jumper that he could jump over a river in just three leaps. And you know, they're playing on the categories from which we construct reality. And yet, you know, they're not academics and thinkers, and they're just pulling the leg of that 17-year-old who doesn't realize that they're being teased. So I think those are the funny ones to me, the most amusing ones.
Nothing like gullibility for a good story.
Right. Right.
Well, it does sound almost a little bit like Gulliver's Travels with sort of the giants a little bit. You do wonder whether there were influences other than, I mean, those lumberjacks, maybe some of them did read, you know,
Gulliver's
stories
travels
as well.
On those long winter
nights.
You
never know.
they certainly may have.
Or they just knew the fairy tales, the Jack and the Beanstalk. I mean,
there are often references to these tales as being like Baron Munchausen, the 18th century popularizer of tall tales. I doubt very much the lumberjacks would have known who he was, but the genre was probably out there. And the Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone stories are mid-19th century, early 19th century. So they're out there too.
And doesn't take too long for even a real story to get exaggerated into the superhuman and create a Paul Bunyan, whether there was really a person there at the kernel of it all or not. But it's been a fascinating walk through the woods and through American folklore with our guest today. Michael Edmonds, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Charles Cohen will be our guest, and with him we'll be looking at that great American tradition, Thanksgiving, through the centuries, how it's changed. You might be in for some surprises. Right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.